afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
For advertisement of the week goes to Dr. Michael Moore.
No.
Yeah, because they have this. He's a chiropractor, by the way. Over on Victor and Hartnell. He's on Hartnell. I would look up the address and everything, but it's on my phone in the other room that we're using to connect with our guests. we're having a little challenge today. So anyway, my lower back went out, and they have this thing. It's a decompression table where you kind of get stretched.
Oh, so they put your feet in it and then touch the table?
No, oh. You don't do those. Oh. By the way, that's Kathy Grindstaff. She's our, I was going to do that after, but now that we got a little time here, we might as well talk about it. So you know those things that flip you upside down?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're really bad for you. They cause people to have strokes. That's why they quit using them. Because apparently our arteries and stuff in the top half of our body are thinner than the ones in the bottom half because gravity pushes the blood down there and then it's got to go back up the other way. But when you flip it around, too much pressure.
Boop. Wow.
So they don't do that. You lay down flat and it's kind of like kind of reminded me of a weightlifting belt. A little bit, like a kidney belt that you would wear. So one kind of goes around like your upper torso and one kind of goes around that hip area. And then they set it up based on your height, your weight, you know, what part of the body they're targeting, blah, blah, blah. And it sort of pulls just a little bit, like a little and then lets go and then a little more, holds it for a few seconds, a little less, more, less. And you do this like nine, you can do it as many times as you want, but I had this pinched nerve that made it so that I pretty much swore all the time. It's like I had Tourette's.
So it's not like the Inquisition.
No, it wasn't like, well, it could have been, but it was, but you didn't, the object wasn't to get you to say anything. They wanted me to stop saying things because everything I said was inappropriate. Because I learned, I don't know why with intense pain, screaming out like balloons or confetti or,
I know,
you know, ice cream, it just doesn't relieve the pain, but swearing does. Somehow.
So there's a lot of people in pain.
Yeah. Uh-huh. A lot of swearing. But no, so it kind of builds up and then each time you do it a little bit longer and everybody's probably different a little bit, but, I've done it four times. So last, like a week ago Friday and then Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And, I can walk around and lean over and get in and out of the car and sleep all night and,
a miracle.
It was kind of a miracle, yeah. Really, actually, sort of a miracle.
Cool.
So, if that, wherever you live, you should probably check that out if you're having I'm going to do it on my neck next, as soon as I get this lower back thing squared away. I've never had lower back problems, ever.
Oh.
And it was like, holy cow, is this what people were talking about? The worst!
I never went to a chiropractor till I was rear-ended in a car crash.
Oh.
And I went for my neck, and I tell you what, I was all about it. I was like,
I've been going to the chiropractor since I was like 20.
Oh. Hey guys, your
yes,
your guest is on the phone.
Get out! Don't get out. That's what happened last time. I lied. The wrong thing. Stay on.
Stay put.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Oh man. So we've got chiropractic care covered. Let's move on to. Let's move on to marijuana. Oh my goodness! All right, so hold on here. We got to reconnoiter. We actually have Dr. Stuart Reese on with us today. He is in Australia. I'm not sure which part of Australia. I forget. Oh, Brisbane.
Western Australia.
Yes. So let's see. He's a family physician working in Brisbane, Australia, where he runs a large clinic. With a special interest in the medical treatment of drug addiction. He's interested in both the underlying pathophysiology. Say that several times. Maybe I'll shout that next time my back goes out. Pathophysiology of drug addiction. How drugs work in the body and why they're so destructive to long-term health. And God knows we need more people looking at that. He's also works on the treatment of drug addiction, including its radical cure. So he's got a long-standing interest in cannabinoids, particularly as they relate to genotoxicity. And we're going to talk a lot about that, genotoxicity. That's kind of like the word of the hour. So he sent us a really interesting paper on epigenetic aging, which normally people would be like, what? But you really ought to take a look at it. I've posted it for you on the page for today. Today is June 7th, 2026. And I've linked a previous show with him from December 12th where he talked about the genetic effects of use of cannabis. So I think that this is the, how about the untold story or the dark side? I guess the whole thing is a dark
side.
Well,
yeah, the part that nobody wants to talk about, but it's a fact.
It is a fact. So, Dr. Reese, for the people who didn't read your terrific email you sent us and the research, can you kind of lay this out for them a little bit? And hello.
Hi. Look, I'm calling you on the mobile. Can I try and call you on WhatsApp?
Oh, I thought we already did that. Back to Alex. Back to Alex in the other room.
He's on the hard line.
He's on the hard line.
Oh, he's on the dial.
Oh, is that the line? Oh. Okay, back to Kathy and Bill and Aaron talking about nothing.
I'll call you in a moment, okay?
Okay. Yes. Talking to other parts of the world is... You know, we had a chat one time with a guy who was a tribal leader from Libya living in exile. And he was in a cafe in Egypt, and we chatted with him. I'm like, hey, we pulled that off.
Yeah, you could hear the cars going by.
You could. It was really funny.
It was pretty strange.
We also, hey, Alex, he's actually calling my cell phone. So I don't know what you do with that. Oh, whoops, it stopped. I'm going to need another stretching treatment. Actually, we're all going to need a stretching treatment.
We need a house call.
We need it. Yes, we do. So he uses I'm going to just continue on kind of a little bit with his bio here. He extensively uses advanced space-time statistical analytical techniques and formal techniques of causal interference to analyze not just associations across space and time simultaneously, but also quantitatively to evaluate the evidence for truly causal relationships. So he isn't just, well, let's face it, the medical applications for cannabis are not studied. Well, they have been studied a lot.
Yeah.
And come up with nothing. So that's always like, I had a friend who smoked it and felt better. And
I think they come up with something. It's just nobody wants to talk about it.
You know what? That's a really good idea. So yeah. It isn't that they haven't proven it has no medical validity. It's that
nobody really wants to talk about it. Because you and I know that, you know, all the pro-marijuana people want to say, oh, it cures cancer. Oh, it cures this. It cures that. And there's no proof of that. But yet they don't want to talk about what it does do.
Yeah.
Okay, just to be clear,
I'm back.
He is on the hard line for the rest of the show.
He just said he's back.
Alex, you shouldn't promise things. We should just float them as possibilities.
Yeah, I get you.
Get us all excited. We feel all good about it. All right, so Dr. Reese, we know that marijuana has been studied a lot for medical use, and there's never been a confirmed medical use through a real scientific study that has been proven. On the flip side, your research is showing that not only is there damage in the immediate time period, but the future as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Aaron. It's probably not true to say that there are no trials for cannabis at all. It has been tried in some forms of resistant pediatric epilepsy, and it is widely recommended for spasm and multiple sclerosis, but obviously that's much less than 1% of the reason that it's used in the general community, because it's certainly used in community people. But, you're dead right when you talk about the long-term effects, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. Since I last spoke to you, we've published a textbook on this subject called The Epidemic, 2,500 pages long.
Yikes.
And we've recently just had It goes into these things in great detail. Strongly recommended, Elsevier. It's available on Amazon. And we've recently just had three papers published looking at holes in the heart, and one of them in the Journal of Perinatology, which is a Nature journal. So it's in one of the top families of science journals worldwide. And, yeah, I'd love to talk about the long-term side effects of cannabis today, because that's a vastly under-discussed and not understood issue, which is not given its relevance in the community. So I'd love to just bring you up to speed on some of the things that have been happening and just let your readers, acquaint your readers with what's going on in the research in that area.
Yes, please, because it's been, we have not spoken with you since December of 2021, if you can believe it. And that was,
I'm
positive you've done all sorts of things since then. So, yes, you can feel free to start wherever you'd like. We've got about 4 minutes until we need to take a quick break, but let's go.
Okay. Well, look, before I start talking about the effects of cannabis, I'd like to talk about what's happening with cannabis in the U.S. It's obviously, the cannabis industry call it the fastest industry in the world, which might be correct. There's a survey in the U.S. called the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. They call it the NISDA, which tracks three key indices of cannabis use in the U.S., which use in the last year, use in the last month, and use on most days in the month. Now, that last one's a critical one, because if you're using 20 to 30 days a month, then you're basically a cannabis addict, cannabis-dependent, cannabis use disorder. So that's diagnosing right over DSM-5 right there. And all three curves, when you track them longitudinally, are showing exponential growth. More importantly, they actually show, the three curves all show an uptick in 2007 and about 2017, which is when apparently there were significant regime changes. And if you look at the slopes of the three curves in those three periods, you find that the use in those days, the slope increased 60 times. The use in the last month increased 100 times at the slope of the curve. And the use in the last year increased 12 times. The most days, using on most days, very interesting, that's the cannabis dependency there. The rate of use of Americans who use cannabis on most days of the month increased from 2% in 2007 to 4% in 2017, so it doubled in 10 years, and then about 8% in 2023, so then it doubled in 5 years. And as I said, it's got a non-linear trajectory due to these changes in the regime, in the way cannabis is thought about, presumably in America. If you look at the THC concentration of the cannabis of smoke, the average that's reported across the U.S., this is reported from the University of Mississippi Analytical Lab. That rose from 2%, a national average, 2% to 18%, 2% in the 90s to 18% about 2023, 2024, which is a ninefold rise. The percentage of high potency cannabis in Department of Drug Enforcement Agency rose from 28% in 2009 to about 80% in 2023. And the monthly cannabis used in the last month rose from about 6% to about 15%. Now, those three rises I've just mentioned is ninefold, 2.4-fold, and 2.6-fold. Now, if you multiply those together, you find that the U.S. population was exposed to 56 times more cannabinoids in that period. If you multiply the THC concentration by the high potency concentration by the increase in the use most days, the cannabis use disorder, you get 86 times more cannabinoid exposure. This is across the whole country. So what that means is that obviously most Americans don't smoke cannabis yet, but it's everybody's problem. There's nearly 100 times as much exposure of the community to cannabis, and that's a big issue. So the next subject I want to just touch on is autism. The CDC Atlanta, Georgia actually maintain four main databases for the rates of autism in the U.S. You've probably heard of that. And two of the databases, Medicaid database, and the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, the ADAM Network, both show an exponential rise over the 30 years of their, 20 or 30 years of their history. Medicaid went up 8%, and the ADAM Network regime went up fivefold, but the Medicaid story is a bit longer than the ADAM Network, so that might be why. So you've got this huge exponential rise in autism that has been in the news, and the president's talked about it. Now, in 2019, we published about autism, and we were worried that it was related to cannabis. And based on data up to 2011, we predicted going forward that the rate of autism in the U.S. under a decriminalized regime would be 293 per 10,000. And as you know, the president was talking about 1 in 31, which is 322. So it just came out a little bit ahead of where we said. But the point was we did it just on the projecting for the exponential growth rate for 14 years from 2011 to 2022. We were pretty much on the money. We estimated 293, and the number came out at 322. And using the same techniques now, you can project that forward, assuming continued exponential growth, to 565 autistic per 10,000 children in 2030 and 881 in 2036. So that's assuming there's no major regime changes. And as you would be aware now, the president is actually talking about that.
Now, well, as I mentioned at the opening, when we have to take a really quick break. When we come back, can you, I realize this involves all sorts of, you know, complex science and stuff, and I know you can't really, you know, build us a house over the radio, but can you explain why the cannabis link would cause autism? Like, what is it that's going on in there for, you know, regular people? I know the science is probably fairly clear, but just so if somebody was going to go out and make that claim, I always think if we don't educate people and allow them to actually go make the case themselves, then we haven't really helped them go spread the word. So maybe we could peel that apart a tiny bit when we come back. Our guest is Dr. Stuart Reese. He's joining us from Australia, which is kind of fun, doing a ton of research on cannabis, and Kathy and Bill and I are learning. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. There's our shout out to Officer Joe, who usually sits in with us. He loves that song. And yeah, that's a much more glamorous version of what it's like to be involved in that industry, I suppose.
Okay, one last little thing I have to shout out is with all the Silver grads we had this year, so 9 high schools in Shasta County, mm-hmm. we had no deaths, no reportable deaths or crashes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, 3 cheers for you.
Yay.
Your program is awesome.
We try.
We'll have to do a little promotional on that here in just a minute. Okay. Dr. Reese, back to you. So why is this why is autism going up with all this? Is it exposure or use or both?
Well, yeah. It's cannabinoids and not just THC, but probably all of them. Look, this question, you could talk all afternoon about it. There's dozens of mechanisms, but there are a few key ones that I want to talk about.
Okay.
Cannabis actually interacts with cells through multiple receptors. There's probably over a dozen receptors. A lot of people have heard of the CB1 and CB2 receptors. There's six TRPV receptors. There's three G-protein coupled receptors. There's an abnormal cannabidiol receptor. There's PPAR alpha and gamma receptors. There's many, many receptors that are involved in transducing the signal of cannabinoids, and they're not just on the cell membrane, they're actually inside the organelles inside the cell. Mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum, have CB1 and CB2 receptors, and they have the full cannabis transduction machinery that transduces the signal from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell cytoplasm and inside the cellular organelles that I mentioned. But there's several key things that I want to talk about, particularly that are relevant. Cannabis damages the genes themselves. It cuts the DNA. It cuts the chromosomes. So it's directly genotoxic. Everybody knows what the DNA looks like. It looks like that spiral helix we've all seen so many times. But it actually carries little switches on the DNA. Because if you think about it, you've got many different cells in your body, but different cells. You've got a heart cell and brain cell and muscle cell and skin cell. The same DNA, but clearly different genes express skin cells, heart, skin genes, heart genes, brain genes. So it must be the different genes that are used, and the genes that are used on the DNA are determined by the software that controls the genes. Now, scientists call that software the epigenome. Epi is upon or after the genome. So it's the software that controls the genes. It actually switches the genes on and off. And what you don't see on most of the spiral helix illustrations that we see is it carries little tiny switches on the DNA, 1 and 2 carbon atoms, methyl groups, single carbon groups, which turn the DNA on and off. The DNA itself is wrapped around 8 proteins called histone proteins. DNA in cell is about 2 meters long, and it's actually rolled up and packed away neatly inside the cell. And the access of the transcription machinery to the genome is controlled by the histones and the epigenetic machinery. So the DNA is coiled up around the histones, and those coils themselves are coiled, so it's super coiled. So the access, if the transcription machinery can't get to the genes, then they can't be transcribed. And obviously the heart cell is using the heart genes, the brain cells using the brain genes, the skin cells using the skin genes, and so on. So the software that controls the genes and gene access is critical, and that's called the epigenome. And it turns out that cannabis has a very heavy epigenetic footprint. So it damages about 20,000-25,000 genes in human cells, and cannabis significantly alters at least half of them, and probably more in some studies. So all the studies looking at the software program, the effect of cannabis on this software programming layer, the epigenome layer, are strongly positive. All of them have very strong signals. The other thing you need to understand is that bodies in general, and the brain and the heart in particular, are actually sort of woven together in 3 dimensions over time, which is 4 dimensions. So the body has, just imagine a weaver's loom. It has a woof and a warp, and it's got chemicals called morphogens, which create the woof and the warp, and cannabis messes up most of those key morphogens. And the morphogens have confusing scientific names like sonic hedgehog and retinoid and bone morphogenetic protein and lots of funny science words like that. But the point is that cannabis mucks up most of the morphogens. So the very framework that the body is being woven together on, that framework itself is bent out of shape. And not only that, but the machinery that writes the epigenome is itself disrupted and perturbed and messed up by cannabis. So the epigenome, the software writes, the epigenome has writers, readers, and erasers. And cannabis mucks up the actual machinery that creates the epigenetic code. So the chaos is chaos. So you have second level chaos, if that makes sense. Cannabis does other things too. The brain is obviously connected to the nerves and muscles and the eyes and everything that makes the body work. So the axons and the way the nerves grow, the axons that grow out of the nerves, have to be guided. And they're guided by molecules called axon guidance molecules, which control the connection of all the cells to each other. And cannabis messes up most of those. So it also damages the energy generation inside cells. Some of you might have heard of mitochondria in biology classes, and cannabis severely messes up the mitochondrial metabolism, which creates, it not only creates all the energy for the cell, and everything that, nearly everything the cell does needs energy, but the genome and the epigenome, the hardware and the software of the genes, is also energy dependent. It needs the energy of the cell, which is usually packaged as ATP, which is mostly produced in the mitochondria, to do stuff. Not only that, but I mentioned the one carbon and two carbon elements, the methyl and acetyl groups, which are the methyls on the DNA, and the methyl and the acetyl groups, the one and two carbon groups, are on the histones that control access to the DNA. They're produced directly by the metabolic machinery. So if the mitochondria that produce the actual the bricks and mortar that go into the epigenome, if that's messed up, then you can see why the wheels fall off out of this. It also has negative effects, cannabinoids also have negative effects on stem cells mostly, and stem cells are obviously what make the body, what make the brain. So if you inhibit stem cell physiology and stem cell division and multiplication, if you inhibit nerve connection, then you're going to mess up brain development. Cannabinoids also, the neurons are connected to each other. They say there's trillions of neurons in the human brain, and each one has 10,000 synapses or connections to the other neurons in the brain. And cannabis messes up that whole connection system. Those synapses, there's a very, very, very complex machinery at each synapse. Each synapse is individually regulated. You know, if you go to the gym and you work out, you get big muscles, then you use it or you lose it, right? That applies to muscles, but it also applies to synapses. And the synapses that have a lot of traffic grow big, and they become giant synapses, and then they can duplicate to increase the traffic across the synapse. But all the complex machinery in each synapse, and if you think of the computational complexity of this, you've got 10,000 synapses in each neuron, each functioning independently and collectively, and it's also collectively upregulated and downregulated for a period of heavy traffic. And then the neurons all fire together, and if cannabis messes up all of that, and it messes up the connection, and it messes up the new stem cell formation, and it messes up the guidance of the neurons, the new neurons that are born, they're called neuroblasts, the baby nerve cells, and then they migrate from the place where they're born, near the ventricles, deep inside the brain, across the cerebral cortex, to form the very complex human cortex. If that whole migration process is messed up, which it is by cannabinoids, then you can see that you couldn't possibly have a normal brain. The same sort of principles apply in the heart, right? The heart is actually put together from six different parts of the embryo when it's developing inside the mother. You know, they've got the primary heart field, the secondary heart field, the lateral heart field, the pre-proepicardium, even the neural crest, which is at the back of the neck. Cells migrate from there into the heart. So you've got a complex choreography, and similarly in the brain development too, is a complex choreography. It's like a dance. It's like an orchestra, a composition. These cells, in a very complicated but carefully timed manner, move together to form the developing human heart. And if you study embryology and how the brain, how the heart, how these other organs are made, it's like watching a sophisticated dance. But all of it is carefully controlled by the genes and the epigenetic information, the epigenome. And if cannabis mucks up the genome, the epigenome, and the morphogen framework that it's built, and axon guidance, and cell division, and cell multiplication, you can see why it messes up embryonic development so egregiously in every organ system.
So is this, once it's done this damage, say an adult who's a user, it's done all this cell damage, is it reversible, or does it repair itself with non-use?
Well, that's a great question, Bill. the answer seems to be, to an extent, yes. As you'd probably expect, if people stop poisoning themselves with some toxin, then they recover. But a lot of the studies are showing that ongoing residual damage. Like there was a, one of the world-leading laboratories in studying the epigenome in cannabis is actually at North Carolina at Duke University. There's a fabulous group who've done lots of hard-hitting research in this area. And they showed that indeed when users stopped and they looked at humans and rats, so they sort of, you know, and looked at the parallels together and the results were essentially similar. They did improve, but some of the changes didn't get better. Like and in fact, what happens with cannabis and it activates these genes is that a lot of the genes that get activated are actually cancer genes. And the cancer genes get activated by the cannabis, and when they stop, they tend to largely settle down. But some of them don't, and some of the ones that don't settle down are actually the genes for ALL and AML, which is acute lymphoid leukemia and acute myeloid leukemia. And what they showed in a very powerful paper in 2021 called Refraining from Use Diminishes Cannabis-Associated Epigenetic Changes in Human Sperm is that overall it does, coming off cannabis improves things, but some of the genes actually get, these two cancer genes, ALL and AML, actually get activated by withdrawal, which actually fits with what we see in epidemiologically. When we look at patterns of disease in populations, we see that the act of being born as a baby to a cannabis-dependent mother, there's a spike in these two leukemias. ALL is the commonest cancer of childhood, and AML is rarer. But the point is the gene cassettes for these leukemias, which the scientists call leukemogenic gene cassettes, actually are activated by birth, by cannabis withdrawal. So whilst it's true that most genes improve, some of the cancer genes actually get activated by withdrawal. And there's a lot of cancer genes get activated epigenetically by the cannabis. And although I'm saying that they tend to improve, which is true, there are also many changes which persist for long term. So the answer, I suppose, in general terms, is that coming off cannabis does improve a lot of these things, but some of the changes persist, be it in cancer activation, which I've mentioned, or in abnormal brain development. So there, that's the answer to that.
Wow.
Believe it or not, we have to take another quick break. But when we come back, I am curious to know, how much use, I know it totally depends on the person, because it's like everyone, but how long do they have to use it before, they hit a tipping point? And is it age dependent? I'm curious on that too. You are listening to We the People. We are discussing things with Dr. Albert Stewart Reese. Sorry, Stewart is his middle name apparently, and he is a family physician working in Brisbane, Australia. So I found a couple doctor songs I thought I'd play for him. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Thought I had you that time.
Went to my family doctor for a pain inside my head. I told him that since you left me, I was feeling like just about dead. Well, doctor, what can you give me? And could it take one or two? Can you tell me just what it's gonna do? Will it save me from what I'm going through? Will it ease the pain? Will it ease the pain? Will it help to pacify my brain?
People wanna know everywhere I go, what can the answer be? I tell them music is the doctor.
There you go. A couple of good doctor songs for you. I was going to add here, so the last little bit of the bio here for anybody who's going, wow, who is this guy? So Dr. Reese was appointed and now reappointed a professor in the School of Psychiatry and Clinical Neurosciences at both the University of Western Australia and Edith Cowan University in recognition of his many contributions which advance our understanding of, here is your $15 word for the day, the toxicopathological, no, God, I had it. You tell them what it is, and the treatment of drug addiction in general, and cannabinoid exposure in particular. What is it? Toxopathological physiology? Can you rattle that off, Dr. Reese?
Toxicopathophysiology. But
of
the other
course.
Word you struggled over
That's what I meant.
Earlier wasn't causal interference, it was causal inference, which is how do you prove that something causes something using, that was the other word you stumbled over earlier.
Yeah, right? So many words. So many words in your world I stumble over. That's why they have me. I'm going to make Kathy and Bill read it next time. Actually,
thank you.
I'm going to just sit back and just let them go. I'm going to let you introduce yourself, actually. That's what we'll do. So tell me this. Is this, like, somebody smokes pot in high school in their senior year for a little while and then goes about their life and never does it again?
Yeah.
I mean, how much damage is that versus like lifetime use and all that?
Yeah, well, in general terms, there does seem to be what we call that a dose response relationship. The more, you know, garbage in, garbage out, the more poison you put in your body, the more damage it's going to do. But it's not always the case, and some people are highly sensitive. Some people are actually allergic to it. Like if the neighbor next door is smoking, some people, they get a rash, they get itchy, they get hay fever, their eyes water, and they can't stop scratching, and even their airways can close over. They get an anaphylaxis because somebody down the street is smoking the weed, and they're getting it in the wind coming up. So some people are acutely allergic, and that's well described. The other category of people is people who have been exposed in utero and had kind of a smoking parents or growing up and grew up around it, and their system changes in a way, and they can become not exactly allergic but super sensitive due to the epigenetic reprogramming that happens in their immune system. So the dose response thing is, in general terms, it's what you'd expect. The more you have, the more damage you do, and certainly there's evidence of that in the legal paradigms. The states which have more cannabis exposure have higher rates of autism, higher rates of holes in the heart. So we can actually see that, but it's sometimes it's not always true, and there are people who are allergic and hypersensitive.
So if somebody, say, never was involved with any of this, but winds up with, I don't know, cancer at the age of 50 or something like that, and they convince them that this is good for them, now what? What do you see on that? I mean, I'm real curious about the age continuum. You said there is an aging factor.
There's use. Because the genotoxicity, aging is not terribly well understood. But the latest science from Harvard and places like that suggests that aging is due to, well, I think there's about a dozen things that are thought to feed into the aging process at the mechanistic level, at the mechanism level. But the key drivers is damage to the genome, the epigenome, and the metabolism that actually presents the 1 and 2 carbon fragments that I was talking about to the epigenome. And those three things are closely related, and they're impacted by what's going on in the immune system and all the other 12 things that relate to aging. Feed into that central system. So because it damages the genome, the epigenome, and the metabolome, cannabis accelerates aging right across the field. And this is starting to be studied in great detail. There's a lot of people starting to look at this, and most of these studies are finding that cannabis does accelerate the aging process. Remember I said the epigenome controls the genes. If you think about, you know, you when you were sort of 16 and when you were sort of 66 and when you're 96 one day, the DNA will be the same, but the way that DNA is used is different And obviously the software is shutting down the DNA with age because the software changes. So those epigenetic changes or loss of epigenetic information which cannabis causes, and part of the cause of that is because it causes the DNA breaks, the chromosomal breaks, which force the epigenome to rearrange itself, which is the pro-aging thing. So that's one of the powerful things. And we'll come to this a bit later, but if you think about it, the extent of aging that's produced varies depending on what study you look at and what age you look at. But you could say that for heavy users, in the general population of an age of about 40 or 50, it probably increases about a 50% of the age, the biological age rate, right? So this is an addictive drug. It's doubling. It's growing fast in the U.S. population. If we were to take the whole U.S. adult population and increase their biological age 50%, it's been calculated in an initial way that would about double the health expenditure, right? The U.S. annual GDP is $30 trillion. And currently spent about $5 trillion on health, and it's been calculated in at least a preliminary fashion that increasing the age by 50% would about double the health expenditure. And if you take the people over 60, the age of 60, who over 55 constitutes 30% of the U.S. population, they're responsible for 60% of the health budget, and you increase their biological age by 60%, then again, you're more than doubling the health expenditure each year. So that's pretty frightening. Because, you can add $8 trillion to the health budget every year just by making the population older, which is where this is going. You know, in the industry's own words, it says it's the fastest growing industry in history, which might be correct. But, autism is rising exponentially. Cannabis is holes in the heart, atrial septal defect is rising super exponentially. I said before that the cannabis is rising exponentially. But one of the important, there's two important take-homes in this whole discussion. Firstly is the effects of cannabis on the body are they exponentiate with time, with dose. As the dose in the lab is raised, you get a super exponential response. And that's what you see in a lot of the epidemiology. When we start talking about holes in the heart, which is what we wrote about recently, we actually see that in the epidemiology of the U.S. population as well. So the first point is that the damage is exponentially related. And the second big point is that it's not just it's probably all the cannabinoids, because it's related to something called a levitol, which is the nucleus of the cannabinoids, and all the cannabinoids that you've ever heard of share it. So delta 8, delta 9, delta 10, delta 0, delta 1, delta 11, they all have the levitol nucleus. And cannabidiol and cannabidiol and cannabichromine and cannabinol, they've all got so they're all genotoxic because they've all got the levitol nucleus, and that's the key point. And we are unleashing this genotoxic and epigenotoxic tsunami across our population, which, I'll show you in a minute, when we get on to talking about the holes in the heart. The rate of holes in the heart in the defense force has gone up about 2.4-fold, right? That's in the defense force, right? So, the implications of this stuff are horrific, and that's why autism is rising in the U.S. We've shown, and others have shown now, that cannabis causes autism, not the only cause, but is a major and primary driver. And we've given us to a neurotoxic drug, a drug we know is neurotoxic, to the community and allowed it to become this massive industry. We're actually marketing addiction for profit. We're marketing disease for profit. Mm-hmm. We're marketing aging for profit. We're marketing insanity for profit. All the major mental illnesses, right, anxiety, depression, PTSD, psychosis, schizophrenia, bipolar, suicidal acts and thoughts, and even in America in homicides, a lot of these mass homicides, those people are cannabis positive, they're all related to cannabis. All the major mental illnesses related. So we're actually marketing physical and mental illness for profit, which is the train wreck. And that's why I'm mentioning today, we've mentioned autism already, and hopefully we'll get onto holes in the heart in the near future. But that's why this is important. And even although, in a minute we'll talk about how we know that holes in the heart, atrial septal defect, is growing faster than exponentially in the U.S., and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the point isn't really about autism or holes in the heart. The point is this is where the genotoxicity becomes visible, right? Because we don't have blood tests. There's no blood test you can have for your biological age. You can't go down to your local doctor and say, doctor, give me a blood test. Tell me what my biological age is. That test is coming, but it hasn't been invented yet, right? But the genotox, you know, the cancer takes decades to come out usually unless you're a baby and you're born and, you know, the mechanism that I was talking about before. But with autism and atrial defects, it's visible because a lot of the birth defects, we showed that 44 birth defects in the U.S. are linked with cannabis. And in Europe, our work shows that of the 95 birth defects they track, America, the CDC track about 66 birth defects, but the list has changed over time, but 44 of those you found to be linked. And in Europe, they track 95 in Europe, and we found that 89 of them could be linked to cannabis. But all of that sort of babies are out there. But a lot of this stuff is the pre-cancer changes that happens in cells, the activation of cancer gene cassettes that you can't see. There's no obvious blood test. And the aging is a really big one that is most concerning and is the really big ticket number in terms of the health budget. You can't see it. But with autism and atrial defect, you can see it. And that's what's worrying us so much about this, is that we've got an exponentially growing autism epidemic. We've got a hyper-exponentially growing atrial defect epidemic, which all indicates, because we understand enough about, of course we don't know all these things, that's why science is ongoing, but what we know is this will drive aging, and so we are doing terrible things to our community, and it's the ultimate business model, right? Because the cannabis industry gets the revenue from it, and the government picks up the tab for the law and order, for the mental health, for the unemployability, for the tent cities, for all the medical costs. It's just a crazy business model, and they talk about the taxes that, taxes that they're going to get from testing the system. But if you're talking about doubling the whole health expenditure through aging, then you're not even close. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and then you swing over to the part where, it's harmless. It's better than pharmaceuticals. It's natural.
God's plan.
God's plan. I love that. I like that one too. And just to be clear, it doesn't matter if you put it in, like, edible candy, smoke it, vape it. It doesn't matter the way that it's taken in, correct?
Correct. That's right, Aaron. Look, I was just thinking about all of this, and I was thinking about snake oil. Because you know how cannabis is alleged to fix everything.
Oh, right, right.
These days, as you said before, there's critical trials for just one or two indications, but obviously the industry's way outgrown that. I searched out what happened, how did snake oil get turned around, and what justified it. And the snake oil stuff was found to be full of opiates and alcohol, up to 40% alcohol, opiates, cannabis, and morphine, all this stuff. And that's why it was working. Eventually it got put away. But the justification is exactly the same as we're here today.
Right, yeah. We've already seen this.
The snake oil thing, this was the U.S. in the late 19th century, right? It stopped about 1910. But people said, people have a right to choose. Government shouldn't interfere. Traditional remedies are being suppressed. Scientific authorities are biased. It's all the same stuff we're here today. And it's just a clone 100 years later. You know, snake oil was supposed to cure everything. Well, I suppose it's full of alcohol and opium, it probably did in a way.
Because you couldn't tell.
If you're stoned, it doesn't matter, right?
Right.
But it's the same thing now. There's no clinical trials for the 100 or so indications. And it's way overblown. And the thing is a cultural phenomenon of its own right. There is so much evidence of the stuff that I'm talking about. To actually reject it, you have to reject science itself in the name of personal freedom and personal hedonism. And that's the issue, but I mean the NIH, I don't know what the budget for the NIH is, but it's pretty big. But if we're not going to take any notice of science, then what are we doing science for, right? Because, you know, like I said, we were able to forecast 14 years in advance what the rate of U.S. autism was, and you know, you blew through that. You know, we calculated 293 for 10,000, and the U.S. came in at 322 in 2022.
Oh my gosh, hold that thought. We are talking about the hole in the heart situation and all of that with Dr. Reese. I hope that you'll take the time to take a look at some of the information he has sent us with links. You can find that on our page June 7th, 2026, or just click on the POT tab at the top of We the People Radio.
.us.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Kunduff.
And I'm Kathy Grindstone.
Yes, I was going to say our. And we have Kathy in here with us today because?
Because I care about the youth and cannabis use.
Yes. And talk about your organization.
I work for Shasta County Chemical People. We are the premier drug prevention agency in Shasta County.
But you are not a county agency.
But we are not a county
You're
agency.
You're an agency in the county.
Yeah. We get no funding from the county, but we are in the county, and we service the entire county, clear from Fall River all the way to Igoe. The whole county. We're here for everybody.
You guys do all the sober grad stuff and all that?
Sober grads, Red Ribbon Week, just a lot of different things. We also, a little hidden thing that we do is the victim impact panel class, which means if you get a DUI in Shasta County, you'll be hearing from me. Oh. So, yeah, so we do a lot of different things. And our programs are free to the schools and to the students. And we do Friday Night Live and Club Lives. I personally work with middle school kids. I love those kids. They're amazing. Sometimes you always wonder if they listen to you, but I found out this last year when I was giving them little quizzes on drug facts and marijuana facts, and they got all the answers right. And so
they were listening.
They were listening. So,
nice.
You know, doing our job.
I like it. So how could people support you?
Actually, we do take donations. Go to our website. Either that, come by the office. Say hi. Find out what all we do.
Website is?
Chemicalpeople.org.
I will list it. I will list it right now on the page for today.
Yeah.
I don't know why I didn't.
My
bad.
I know.
It's funny, chemical people, when you hear that, it's
like, I know.
They must be all about drugs.
Well,
they are, but they're
we
all
We are,
about
because we also do, twice a year, we do National Drug Take Back. So we do in October and April. We usually are set up right in front of City Hall, and you can dispose of all your unused and expired medications.
Oh.
Drive up. Drive through. Dispose of them all. We take them all.
Nice.
Cool.
Well, there you go. So you're our free... our free commercial of the day.
Yeah, there you go.
Put it online so you can have it. All right. So Bill wanted to get Dr. Reese started here. We know we're talking about the hole in the heart thing, but before we went there, he had a question for you, Doctor.
Well, not really a question. I just wanted to cover the hole in the heart. And then also I was reading where these babies are being born without a brain and have to live... you know, a few days, but the medical cost of keeping all these kids alive because of the marijuana use is astounding. But maybe we could talk about the hole in the heart and the no brain.
All right. Well, yeah, the no brain, that's actually an important point. There's two CDC papers saying that cannabis doubles the rate of babies being born without a brain. That the medical name for that is anencephaly. Encephal is the Latin word for brain, and A means negative, so it's negative brain. A lot of those babies that die in utero before birth, but some of them live, and most of them live only half an hour or an hour or die in the first few days, because obviously you can't live without a brain. And cannabis actually does that for all the reasons that we talked about earlier, because it actually blocks brain formation. And, you know, the cost, the actuarial cost of a life in the U.S. Is $12 to $15 million, I'm told. And the U.S. has nearly 1,000 anencephalic, about 800 anencephalic kids born a year. So that if you multiply 1,000 times, say, yeah, 15 million, you get 15 billion. Now, I'm not saying that all of those 800 kids are cannabis exposed, but the point is, if cannabis is going to be on this doubling trajectory, I just said that the rate of cannabis addicts in the U.S., according to a leading survey, has doubled and doubled again, and is about to take off like a skyrocket given the proposed changes from the administration. Then, then you've got, it's like the autism thing. You've got a known neurotoxic brain that's loose in the community. I would say what's very important to understand, remember earlier we said that cannabis linked with most of the major, virtually all of the major mental health disorders. The director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, has published, Dr. Bolk has published several times in the New England Journal, leading journals, that cannabis shrinks the head of the baby, which obviously if your head's smaller, your brain's smaller. The CDC, as I just said, has published twice that it doubles, cannabis doubles the rate of anencephaly. And the European data shows clearly that microcephaly is associated with cannabis use. And we've got autism, congenital, exposure of cannabis to the baby causes autism. So you've got a spectrum of damage, right, from slightly smaller head to microcephaly, to no brain at all, to autism and mental illness. This is a clear pattern. That pattern needs to be, I think everybody needs to understand that cannabis actually damages the structure of the brain. And so that's very important. Now, then you asked me about holes in the heart. Yeah, so I'd love to just talk to you quickly about holes in the heart, if that's possible.
Sure. Well, we have a whole hour. Minus a couple little commercials, but we've got good time for you. We're all right.
Okay, great. So a landmark new study published in one of the world's most elite scientific journals, Nature, Journal of Perinatology, has demonstrated that rising U.S. cannabis use is causally responsible for exponential increases in a birth defect commonly called hole in the heart, or atrial septal defect, or ASD, where U.S. rates that measured 10.3 cases for every 10,000 births in 2005 have moved among certain ethnicities to as high as 884 per 10,000 in Nevada and Mississippi in 2020, or about 1 in 11 babies affected. The study used careful statistical adjustments to show that the effect was truly causal. The findings are even more significant when it is recognized that many common birth defects lead to the termination of pregnancy. They have a therapeutic abortion because the baby's too malformed, whereas atrial septal defect generally doesn't. This means that the causal role of cannabis in this particular birth defect may be the canary in the coal mine, signaling not only the likely involvement of cannabis in other birth defects, but that these rises in ASD rates are the bellwether marker for other cannabinoid genotoxic effects, including human aging and many cancers. In Nevada, careful statistical modeling shows an exponential rate of rise with a doubling time of just 2.8 years. You think about that, every 2.8 years, the rate of ASD doubles in Nevada in some ethnicities. Across the U.S., ASD rates are rising faster than U.S. than exponentially. As one reviewer of the Journal of Perinatology paper wrote, regarding statistical analysis and causation, this manuscript has relevance to pediatric cardiologists, neonatologists, and above all to obstetricians who should more strongly advise against the use of cannabis in any form during pregnancy. Indeed, this reviewer believes that this is a landmark study, with the revised data analysis much more strongly points to causation rather than mere association. Extremely important research for public health advisory against cannabis use during pregnancy and most probably for paternal cannabis use during the partner's pregnancy. Other peer-reviewed cannabis population studies by the same researchers show that cannabis is causal in twice as many cancers as tobacco and numerous other birth defects in both Europe and USA. The effects of human aging are extremely concerning indeed when rolled out across whole populations, including eggs and sperm and babies. Now that's interesting because we know that the weed ages the cells generally, but it even ages the eggs and sperm and obviously the babies that form from those damaged eggs and sperm. And if you think about it, it raises the question of the zygote at the moment of fertilization, the fertilized egg, is actually aged. And if you think about it, it's actually aged before fertilization because the eggs and sperm that made it were aged. And you can see these signs of aging under the microscope. That's all known and has been known for about 50 years. So this is an issue that the media urgently need to bring to the attention of the American people, given a heavy salience in this country on medical cannabis, which presents all of these risks to both the childbearing and the general population. This is a discussion we urgently need to have. Now, if you look at the rates, the average rate of atypical ASD across the U.S. states, in 1990 it was 27, and in 2020 it's 116. That's a 4.2-fold rise. As I mentioned, we showed the rate across the U.S. states average is rising faster than exponentially. And it's much higher in the states where cannabis is medical or cannabis is legal. Now, if you look at the height, we our papers have graphs of all the states, of lots of states, not all 50 states, but, well, all the states that have data, the 44 states that have data. But high cannabis states would include Nevada, New York, the Department of Defense, and Kentucky. In Nevada, the rate from 2004 through 2020 rose an average of 12 times. In New York, New York State, it rose an average of 6 times. And in just 4 years in New York, from 2016 to 2020, it doubled from about 76 to 152. In the Department of Defense, it rose, the rate rose from 71 to 164, 2005 through 2018. So that's more than doubled in the Department of Defense, right? In Kentucky, it rose from, let me see here, from 19 to 332 from 2000 through 2020. If you look at the low cannabis states, so some states have low cannabis, states like Florida, Utah, Texas, Georgia, Maryland, Minnesota, Iowa, and South Carolina. Remember, I was talking about rates like 884 and 568 in Kentucky. In Florida, the rate is currently only, the overall rate is 114. In Utah, it's 32. In Texas, it's currently 90. In Georgia, it's 25. In Maryland, it's 12. In Minnesota, it's 12. Iowa is 23. And South Carolina is currently 9. So you have to wonder about the integrity of data collection in those states. But the point is there's a wide spread between high and low states. It's tracked closely with the states where cannabis is legal. The atypical DEFA ASD, there was a powerful paper from Hawaii in 2007, published by Forrester and Merck, called Risk of Selected Birth Defects with Prenatal Illicit Drug Use. And the atypical defect rate in that paper was 6 times higher in the women who smoked weed. There was, remember I talked about the North Carolina group and their research on the epigenetic damage from cannabis. It's important to note that the genes, the gene cassettes that were stimulated by cannabis those affecting the brain, growth, the growth of the whole organism, heart growth, nerve cell growth, immune cell growth, liver lesions, and leukemia. And then they looked at cannabis withdrawal, and they found that the gene cassettes that were triggered with that were blood vessel formation, the hippocampus formation in the brain. The hippocampus is deep inside the brain in all the mammalian species, and it's where memories are formed, and it's very spaceless, and it helps with space, time orientation. Pyramidal neurons, which are some of the main neurons in the cerebellum at the back of the brain. Organismal death was triggered by cannabis withdrawal, the genes for organismal death. Cognitive impairment and learning, those genes were stimulated by cannabis withdrawal. And brain damage and damage to the testicles was also triggered. All these things were damaged by cannabis withdrawal. When we looked at ethnicity across the U.S., we found that the African American and the non-Hispanic American Indian Alaskan Native group was higher across the country. And in Nevada, the ASD, as I mentioned, rate was was growing exponentially and doubling every 2.8 years. When we look at the map of, in a space-time analysis, we looked at a map of where cannabis is, you know, cannabis use rates across the U.S. and the rates of ASD, atrial septal defect, and found that in general there was a close parallel where the more cannabis was used in a space-time analysis, the ASD rate rose, except for certain Midwest states, which is another issue, because remember we said some people are very sensitive. In Kentucky, Senator McConnell, I believe, was from Kentucky, and when the U.S. Farm Bill was passed, a lot of those farmers were helped to change from tobacco to cannabis. And there's a river there, the Cumberland River, and if you've got hundreds of acres sown to cannabis, then inevitably you're going to get contamination of the water stream and the food chain downstream of the water stream. So part of the concern there is that if holes in the heart, and it's common in some of those Midwest states, Tennessee, Kentucky, it may not be driven by smoke cannabis, but it could be environmental contamination through the Cumberland River and contamination from the food chain, contamination, the water table contamination, as happening in parts of California. We know that north of California is notorious as a high cannabis grow area. It's also very high in rates of autism and gastroschisis. Gastroschisis, birth defect, where kids are born with their guts hanging out of their tummy and they have to be treated, they have to be put back. And they, again, are like bellwether markers or you know, index markers of cannabis genotox more generally and of the sort of brain development and everything else that goes with it. So if you just Google cannabis and aging, there's 535 hits on the in the PubMed database. So it's not a subject which is, it is not controversial, you know, 500 hits on it. You know, we showed back in 2016 that looking at vascular age, you've heard of hardening of the artery? Well, you can use those techniques to look at vascular age. We showed a 12% advance in vascular age with cannabis exposure in British Medical Journal 2016. They've looked at acute health problems. Other researchers have looked at acute health problems and chronic health problems, problems like stroke, heart attack, injuries, car crashes, falls, cancer pain, non-cancer pain, coronary heart disease, chronic health conditions, and both acute and chronic illnesses are much more common in after cannabis exposure, which is obviously an aging pattern. You know, heart attack, stroke, falls, hypertension, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. These are all age-related diseases. And then by measuring the age of cells, remember we talked about the epigenome controls the aging and controls the cell type specification. So the reason one cell is a heart cell and one cell is a liver cell is because the epigenome controls all that. And so you can use what's called an epigenetic clock to figure out the age of cells. And using the epigenetic clock, researchers from University of Virginia and Duke in 2022 showed that at the age of 30 years, patients were an average of 30% older. And your other research shows that age, you know, you roll those numbers out across the U.S. population, it's really a deal breaker in terms of every budget. Shows that the aging gets worse as they get older. So you know, you're 60 years old, the aging thing is likely about 60%, 70 years old, 70%. And it may actually grow faster than a linear effect with age. It may actually be an epidemic.
We've actually found a way to move dog years into the human experience. That's terrifying. We have to take a really quick break, Dr. Reese. I'm sorry. I hate to take breaks during this. We get rid of free enterprise during our show. It's an impediment. but you gotta do it. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Stuart Reese. You can find everything about this program, including his information and research and links, at wethepeopleradio.us. Well, on that note, Dr. Reese, Kathy has a question for you on data.
So all your data is, it blows my mind sometimes. And what I find in our industry when we're trying to research data is most people don't keep track of that, either on the hospitals or doctor's offices or any place. You know, they don't want to report out on, you know, cases of hole in the heart or how did you trace it back to marijuana use or whatever. So how are you getting all this data?
Well, you know, you're right. You're quite right, Kathy, to make those observations. Well, like Erin said earlier, you know, we work with a lot of drug-dependent people.
Right.
And that's why I started worrying about this. I thought, my gosh, if the pattern I'm seeing in my patient cohort is rolled out across the whole community, this is going to be a scary story.
Right.
So that's why we started doing our research. In other words, are these patterns, like I've got several patients who've got kids who've got cancer who smoke a lot of cannabis. Right?
Right.
I mean, we talked about autism earlier, and one of my patients from a cannabis area where they smoke a lot of cannabis, she said, oh, all my friends smoke cannabis. All of us have abnormal, all our kids are abnormal. They're all unteachable. They're all autistic or ADHD or schizophrenic. And I've got a domestic violence order against my son who's schizophrenic and so violent and doesn't take his medication and he's unteachable. I get a lot of teachers coming to see me complaining about stress and violence in the classroom, and now that they're not allowed to use the cane or anything like that, there's a huge issue with, you know, classroom discipline.
Right.
And kids getting out of control, and over again, it's kids who've been exposed to cannabis or their parents are drug addicts or something. So, you know, that's why I was so worried. I thought, my gosh, if this pattern I'm seeing is rolled out across the whole community, we've got serious trouble. So what we did is you can access, it's not easy and it's harder, it takes time, but you can access data, you know, the U.S., that's why it's good to study the U.S., because the U.S. has more numbers on most things than most countries, and their statistics keeping is more careful. So there are national figures, as I said earlier, for last month and last year, cannabis use, there's statistics on those who've used cannabis most days of the month, and you can pair that with the atrial septal defect or the anencephaly or any of the birth defect numbers which are available on different databases, and you can match it all up, and then there are advanced statistical techniques that you can use to demonstrate causation, which is really what we've done.
Right. Yeah, because we're finding, you know, we are in Northern California. We have a very high population that not only grows it and sells it and normalizes it in our community, but to get any data from our local hospitals and doctors, they don't test for that. They don't, you know, it doesn't go anywheres. And I feel like we're not being honest with our community if we can't get this information out.
That's exactly right. And I mean, you know, what you're saying is exactly right. And that's why we're having this chat today. You know, it's obvious that the world is tangled up in lies, and we're going to stay tangled up in lies until we start telling the truth. You know, I'm a firm believer that when you know the truth will set you free. And if we don't start telling the truth right across the country, and in fact, right across the planet, then we're going to be taken captive by the lies of cannabis, which is a cross between its addictive nature and the crass commercialization of the cannabis industry, and they're quite open and proud about that. So,
right.
So you know, I think some of the things we're talking about here, you know, we're talking about some of the biggest subjects in medical research. You know, things like the epigenome and stuff like that. These are some of the biggest subjects that people do research on. There's like 500,000 papers on the epigenome in the literature. There's you know, I think it's about 800,000 papers on stem cells. You know, these are some of the biggest things. That's why I said the evidence for this is overwhelming. Our only chance. See, what we haven't done. So this stuff about cannabis genotoxicity has been known since the 1970s, right? The earliest paper that I know is 1969, right?
and
we've known it's toxic to the genome. I've seen documents from the FDA. Friends have sent me, my American, I've got a lot of lovely American friends, right? You have to understand that, right? Just fabulous people in America, right?
Of course there is. Of course.
Most Australians think America is just amazing, right? FYI, right? But there are documents from the FDA showing that, that cannabidiol, which is supposed to be so safe, is linked with at least half a dozen cancers. So the FDA knows that CBD is genotoxic because cancer is a genetic disease, right? If we don't start telling the truth about this, then we will be taken captive essentially by lies. That's why I want to have this discussion. That's why I'm calling you, you know, from Australia, from Brisbane. It's 5 o'clock in the morning here when we started this call. To tell you this, to get the word out, if we don't start telling the truth about this, then we sort of, you know, throw ourselves in the bottom of the harbour, you know, with lead boots on. If we start telling the truth, you know, remember this stuff is addictive. Now, the definition of addiction is you lose your internal control. That's what the definition of addiction is. You continue despite adverse health and social outcomes and psychological outcomes and employment outcomes, you continue anyway. So internal controls aren't going to work. So we need the regulation of government. We have to tell the truth about this. If we don't start telling the truth about cannabis, then it will take us captive and it will destroy every budget you've ever heard of. You know, I'll come to that in a minute. We have to start telling the truth because then all these things, once, and this genotoxic, we didn't even know about the epigenome in 1969.
Right.
The genome's really only been discovered and elucidated in the last 20 years. But in 1999, they published about, remember I talked about histones? The DNA is wrapped around histones inside the nucleus, and that's how come you can fit 2 meters of DNA inside a nucleus, which is only 1 micron across, because it's neatly packed away inside the histone. The papers looking at the effect of histones on cannabis on histones were not in the 1980s and 1999. Before we even understood what the epigenome was. And now, like I say, there's at least 120 papers on cannabis crashing the epigenome, and we're not talking about it. I mean, I just checked the NIH budget is $49 billion a year. But if we're going to ignore all the research, and if the FDA is going to, you know, let CBD roll out across the country virtually unrestricted, and they know it's genotoxic, then the whole of the train wreck, the rest of the train wreck follows. You know, it's going to crash your, obviously, your health budget. Obviously, your welfare budget. You know.
We've already seen it. Balloon the homeless problem, and anybody who thinks that's not related to drugs hasn't paid attention to the people taking their clothes off in the middle of the street. Hey, Alex has a question. Alex has a little question for you in the midst of all of this.
Yeah. So I worked in the music business, and many years ago, I knew someone who was born to heroin addicts, and it made him very tolerant to recreational drugs, but it also made him very tolerant to pharmaceutical drugs like antibiotics and aspirin or pain medication. Can you speak to that at all?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. You know, we've talked about this software layer on the genes that controls the genes that the scientists call the epigenome. The epigenome is exquisitely sensitive to environmental intoxicants. In particular, the stem cells record environmental exposure in their epigenome. Now, that's important. Think about the blood cells. There are blood cells that whiz around your body. They only last a day or two. So if their epigenome is impacted by drugs and diet and obesity and exercise and starvation, what's going on in the diet, in the environment, because we know it is, then it doesn't matter because the cell only lasts a day or two and then it's past its use by day and it's destroyed, you know, due to lack of interest. But if these things are recorded in the stem cells, which live in the bone marrow and live as long as you live, then the memory is recorded. And that's why this happens. Another lady wrote to me with the same story. You know, I was exposed, you know, in utero and when I was growing up, and now I'm hypersensitive. This is epigenetic reprogramming, and it's recording the epigenome. This is what, this epigenome is huge, right? They're going to develop, I think, in the next 10 years or so, there's going to be aging treatments coming out of our understanding from Harvard Laboratory and other places in the world that are researching this. Treatments for aging coming out of the epigenome. There's going to be treatments for cancer coming out of the epigenome. This is a very, very powerful, very, very powerful genetic regulation. It's only 20 years old because it really only took off in the early 2000s. So absolutely, yes, the environment impacts the epigenome, which is why cannabis and cocaine and opiates and amphetamines all affect the epigenome, and tobacco and alcohol and aging and obesity. These things affect the epigenome. The epigenome, that there was a book once, a very famous book called Your Body Keeps the Score. Well, the epigenome keeps the score. And that's why all this stuff, you know, you think about it, it's unanimous. There's over 120 papers of cannabis and the epigenome. They're all saying don't go there. And yet we're ignoring it. So this is why, you know, I was very keen to have this discussion. We need to start talking. It's fine for scientists to agree about that, but if we don't start to understand this stuff in the community, then in a sense we've signed our own death warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
How does it affect, or will it affect our blood supply, like people that donate blood that are users? Is that blood, it obviously would carry the same genetic code, wouldn't it?
Well, cannabis is fat soluble, so it'll be in the cell membranes. I mean, it has to be. Mm-hmm. But it's not tested for that. And some of the epigenetic code, a lot of those white cells, though, when they infuse them, they're probably dead when you, when they go in the bag of blood, and so they're dead when they come in, and the white cells are destroyed largely, I think, in the body. But that's another question. That's research that, to my knowledge, hasn't been done. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens, because we know, like in cancer patients, we know that the DNA from cancer leaks into the general circulation, leaks out of the cancer cells in the general circulation, and they can use very sensitive, not in hospitals, but in research labs, they can use very sensitive PCR techniques to look at the DNA. There's actually fantastic stories from Hong Kong, which is one of the leaders in this, and they've diagnosed cancers only 1 millimeter across in the nasopharynx through their blood signature. So this is called cell-free DNA. And this is another area of very active research, which is going to lead to, you know, probably transform cancer treatment, but we might be 5 or 10 years away from that, seeing that in common clinical use. But you know, there is a question of, okay, the cells bust, the cells die, so there's some cell-free DNA in the circulation. What are the impacts of that, and how does that epigenome interact with the host epigenome? There is no research looking at those questions that I'm aware of, I'm sorry.
Hmm. Very interesting. Okay, so before we move to one other topic, let's take a really quick break, and then we'll come back and we will have Dr. Reese as our hostage till the top of the hour. At which point we can wrap up with all the others. And obviously we're going to run out of time because there's so much to do. So we're going to thank him for coming on now, because I always run out of time and I never get to tell you thank you at the end. So I'm going to do it 20 minutes early in anticipation of running out of time. Oh, my gosh. So you are listening to We the People. You can find all of this online. We have a huge swath of information under the tab labeled POT. Makes it easy for you. Right at wethepeopleradio.us. I couldn't resist. Sorry, Dr. Reed. Science from Weird Al Yankovic. Go figure. Okay, so what have we not... I mean, I know there's a lot we haven't covered, but
that you might think our listening audience would take home with them.
Yeah, what are they not being, there's so much they're not being told, I don't even know where to start. Forget that.
Well, look, for a lot of politicians, it boils down to the bottom line, which is always the bottom line. So I just thought I'd just make a few comments just for a few minutes on that, if you like.
Okay. Yes.
Well, all of the effects we've talked about are based around genotoxicity. If you understand what we were talking about earlier about the genome and the epigenome driving aging, you can see that by altering the genetic and epigenetic structure of cells, scientists are able to make cells age faster or slower. We can actually reverse the aging process in cells in culture and in animals by using stem cell factors. That is, we can finally tune the biological age of cells by manipulating stem cell factors on one side and genetic and epigenetic lesions on the other. We can, if we damage the genome or the epigenome, we will make the aging go faster. If we use stem cell factors, we can reverse the aging process in cells in culture in the lab and in experimental animals, lab animals, rodents, and things like that. And some of this research is coming out of the top aging labs in the world, including Harvard Medical School and some of the others too, and Mount Sinai Medical School, places like that. This definitely proves causality formally. This proves that this is the process that controls the aging mechanism, the genome, epigenome, metabolome that we've been talking about. Whilst there are complicating factors in the environment, especially drugs, and immune stimulation and other factors feed into this central genome, epigenome, metabolism engine, this is the central story which drives aging. Cannabis damages both the genome and the epigenome, the hardware and the software layers, in exactly and precisely this deleterious pro-aging manner that we've talked about. Published data indicates across the whole community cannabis could accelerate the biological aging rate 30 to 70%, likely increasing with age, which goes up either in a linear or quadratic fashion. Say 50% across the whole community as a ballpark. Now, the USA spends around $3 to $5 trillion annually on healthcare. AI estimates suggest that this would approximately double if the population became 50% biologically older, up to $11 trillion annually. People older than the 55 years constitute 30% of the U.S. population, but contribute 60% of healthcare costs. If that section of population older than 60 grew 60% older biologically, which is what the data points towards, then their health costs are projected to rise 2.5 to 4 times, consuming an extra $5 to $8 trillion per year.
Holy crap.
Note that this is only the first approximation estimates from AI on the current structure of the U.S. population. Our next project will include detailed health econometric modeling of the U.S. population, which is a very lengthy and detailed project. This does not include the cost for severe autism, about $20 million each, and U.S. has 4 million autistic people, which is $80 trillion over a lifetime. This does not include the cost for schizophrenia, about $11 million each if you include 12 months in prison, which a lot of them do. And USA has a million schizophrenics, which is, calculates out, $11 trillion over time. This does not include the cost of anencephalus, babies born without a brain which live only a few hours usually. Two CDC papers state that cannabis doubles the rate of anencephalus, about 14 million each. At almost 1,000 born each year is 14 billion annually, or over a trillion over a 75-year lifetime. Or all of the other 88 birth defects implicated by a European analysis. Each life lost is valued actuarially in the US at 12 to 15 million. U.S. spends around $300 billion on mental health each year. Cannabis has been shown to cause most of the major mental illnesses, anxiety, depression, psychosis, schizophrenia, bipolar affective disorder, and suicidal thinking acts and attempts. Also violence in both intoxication and withdrawal. Now, that's different with cannabis, right? Amphetamine and cocaine cause violence in intoxication, and alcohol causes violence in intoxication. But only cannabis causes violence in both intoxication and withdrawal. And cannabis is also linked with mass homicides. There's a list of over 80 mass shootings in the U.S., all linked to cannabis, almost 80 in a row.
We have that on our website. That is well documented.
That's right. You certainly do. And say cannabis causes, contributes, or exacerbates about 20% of that mental health burden, which is a realistic estimate, is $4.5 trillion over a 75-year lifetime. That's the cost just of the mental health, if you assume cannabis and the ballpark is responsible for 20% of the bill, which is probably where it's going in the very near future. And that's even without talking about cancer. You can find that cannabis has been linked with testicular germ cell tumors in journals as eminent as Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, and Nature Reviews of Cancer. That is important because testicular germ cell tumor is the cancer responsible for the most years of life lost of any adult cancer. And there are many others, which of course is another discussion. Cannabis is now linked with breast cancer, the commonest cancer of all. Acute lymphoid leukemia, the commonest cancer of childhood. And because it's a childhood cancer, it's inherited from damage often from the parents because it's due to faulty genes. And liver and pancreas cancer, which are the two fastest growing tumors, and at least four childhood cancers, proving intergenerational transmission, not just of mutagenicity and teratogenicity, but of carcinogenicity. In other words, you know, before we were talking about birth defects, but now the birth defect is itself a cancer. So you're transmitting transgenerationally to the next generation, not just birth defects, but you're actually transmitting cancer. So you're both mutagenic and teratogenic and carcinogenic transgenerationally. And these epigenetic changes we can talk about, they're inheritable for 3 to 4 generations, the scientists say. So that's the next 100 years of our population. Mm. But please tell me why we are not talking about any of this stuff. It's been
yeah.
9 to 60 years.
That is the...
And the politicians...
That is the... I guess that's... Anybody listening to this would be asking that. Like, why aren't we talking about it? But that's really the call to action at this point, is it's our job to really get this out there.
It's our job to beat the drum. And the politicians will talk about how much money they were raising taxes from everybody getting stoned. What were our lawmakers smoking when they thought that, for goodness sake?
That was asked, just so you know.
I would emphasize that these are preliminary ballpark estimates only. Detailed analysis will be prepared, but may take years to prepare.
The aging thing, just out of curiosity, as I was reading your materials, I was wondering, because cigarette smoking, that's the one thing that we see where you can really see people have aged dramatically. Skin, you know, with their skin, a lot of wrinkling and all that stuff from tobacco smoking. Is that all part and parcel of the same, or is that just a different phenomenon?
That's right. Like I said to you, I've got lots of drug-dependent patients, and the big cannabis smokers, they look like old and wrinkled and shriveled up, and it's just really bad news. Now, there's no blood test for that, but you can actually see it, and I think there are AI programs you can get with face recognition coming out of China and stuff like that. You could actually do research. We haven't done that, but that's definitely something that needs to be done.
Wow. So people spending all this, you know, I mean, besides the fact that you know, you have cancer and all these, it's much more important than what you actually look like. But it is kind of fascinating that people are spending so much money on, you know, plastic surgery and different things like this to try to prolong the effects of aging. But you know,
and then go home and smoke a joint,
or using the
edibles.
CBD and edibles and all that stuff. So even if you're not a pot smoker, it all comes out the same in the wash, the same. Doesn't it?
Yeah. Look, the disinformation is so massive about this in the community that we actually need to start breaking the sound barrier. I actually spoke to a billionaire recently who's got her own cannabis company, of course. And she's putting the CBD cream on herself every night on her face.
Oh.
And she's in Australia, and she's had a lot of sun, so you can really see the sun damage. But she said she wants to use it as an anti-aging cream, and I said to her, you know that's going to make your aging worse? And she said, are you sure? I said, I'm absolutely sure, ma'am.
Wow.
Yeah, people are actually using this stuff as an anti-aging treatment when we know it's going to make it worse. But, you know, there's really no doubt about that. You know, I just... You know, when I looked at PubMed database, there's nearly 740,000 references on aging, on the research on aging, it's the main database. Stem cells is 500,000. The immunity, there's 2 million results. You know, epigenetics, 200,000. These are some of the major subjects in science they're talking about. You know, to actually say cannabis is okay and it's a soft drug and roll, that is the one thing this data explodes. It explodes that soft drug image. It explodes it, not just for cannabis. Not just for THC, Delta-9 THC, but all the cannabinoids, generically, and the FDA hold this information in their own files, and we're not being told. We need to start talking about it. We need to break the sound barrier on so that everybody knows, because when everybody knows, it's obvious what we need to do. I mean, you're talking about destroying the genome for the next four generations, the next 100 years of our people, and you're talking about, you know, multi-trillion dollar health bills alone, without the welfare dependency, without the unemployment, without the underemployment, without the crime, without the mental illness. You know, it's just, the genotox of cannabis has been known for 6 years, and we're not talking about it, and that, to me, this is transformative. And certainly in England, these themes have been given a major airplay in England, and that's the reason that England is a lot stricter with it. That is the big reason that England is a lot stricter on cannabis than the US, because it hasn't had airtime in the US. But in my view, you know, we need to start showing the truth about this stuff. We need to get it out there. We've got a lot of the top journals in medicine, Lancet, New England Journals, Nature Reviews of Cancer. These are the top journals in the world. They're unanimous on this stuff. And we are not talking about, we need a giant reality check. We need to ring those fire bells and get this message out there. You know, I'm not a social media person, but we need, this is a media, social media, a traditional media, a legacy media problem. We need to break the sound barrier on this, or we will be choked in the lies that the industry is telling us for profit.
And the ones who will pay the most will be
our
kids.
Children.
Yeah.
Yep. And our children's children. And our children's children's children.
Well, and based on the multi-generational thing, I think that for me was the, like, when I think of, when I see your name in our archives, I immediately think of the, when you taught us what whippersnippers were way back when, that it took a whippersnipper to your chromosomes, which was a weed whacker for those of you who didn't hear the original program. And I've never been able to get that out of my mind. So if you have somebody who is a cannabis user, and then maybe they stop, but they ultimately have children with somebody who is also a cannabis user or a child of, you start making those combinations, and eventually you can't stop it. You can't stay out of the loop. I mean, you're constantly reinforcing the damage.
Yeah, but it's worse than that. See, like I said.
No, wait, that was the really bad news. There's more.
No, that's the happy news. Because you're talking about volitional direct exposure. What about indirect exposure through people who are allergic, or it's in the wind or the pollen?
Oh, yeah.
Or it's in the food chain because the water is contaminated and the environment is contaminated. It's in your food chain. So you could be a very respectable person who wouldn't smoke or drink in a fish, but then you go to the fridge,
right,
and it's in your
that.
Milk, it's in your eggs, it's in your bacon.
Not the bacon. No. No, I draw the line there. Not the bacon. That is just craziness. Hey, and, you know, in all seriousness, except for the bacon, the Epoch Times will be putting something out regarding the chemicals in some of our Northern California marijuana situation and the proliferation of chemical exposure there. And I think people should be terrified about that. Actually, that's firsthand.
Yeah.
I've seen that firsthand.
Yeah.
And the volume of chemicals.
In our water system.
In your water system.
It's just nuts.
Wow.
Yeah, you see, this is the actual complete reversal of the drug debate, right? The drug debate started out, you know, I've got a right to use drugs, it's my civil liberty, and you can't interfere,
right.
You can't tell me what to do, right? Whereas now, if it's in the food chain and the water table and the environment is contaminated, we've lost the right not to take drugs and not to have kids with people who also aren't drugs, so that our kids aren't drug affected. That right has been taken away. This is a total reversal. We need to start talking about this stuff. And one thing, I mean, you know, which I've noticed is, you know, mothers care a lot about their kids, and they're also incredibly good networkers. So we need, that is a winning combination. We've got the compassion, we've got the care, we've got the concern, and we've got that network. We've got to start, you know, making those Bush telegraphs arm on this.
Yeah, and they are the ones who are going to be the biggest influence. So Kathy and her organization has come out really strong about all the edibles and the things that look just like candy and are not candy and all of that. So we are in the last like 20 seconds here with our friend Dr. Stuart Reese. We really appreciate you coming on with us today. I know I don't even remember what time it is there, but something crazy. And so thanks for figuring out how to make it happen. And we are looking, well, we're not really looking forward to your next batch of information for us, but we are.
We appreciate it.
We really do appreciate the time and the knowledge.
It justifies everything that we say and we try to teach our
public. Absolutely. So your job, everyone, go out, share the program. You can find it at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Somebody gotta shake things up. Somebody gotta shut things down. Somebody gotta strike a match, break the ice, and light a first round. Somebody gotta go all night. Somebody gotta dig down deep. Mean what they say, say what they mean. The way I see, you might as well.